Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Kevin O'Connor. In addition to writing and publishing Two Floors Above Grief, Kevin O'Connor enjoys chronicling the stories of families and friends through tracing genealogical histories, writing, and picture collections. His prior writing includes personal letters, articles in professional publications, dissertation, anthologies, and presentations delivered at conferences, seminars, and webinars. He brings people together personally and professionally. Collaborating with friends and relatives, he plans family and class reunions. He has performed in over 30 theater productions since the 1970s. He has been active with Smart Ride, a bicycling group that rode annually from Miami to Key West, raising funds for HIV awareness, treatments, and education. He was an elementary teacher, principal, professor, and curriculum coordinator in California, Illinois, and Florida from 1973 to 2020. In his final educational position, he authored content and provided training in areas including support for LGBTQ advocacy and sexual health and family life. He resides in Fort Lauderdale with his husband, Leon. Their family includes 5 sons and 7 granddaughters. He references further connections to this book, continues the stories, and highlights perspectives about his interest at www.kevinoconnorauthor.com and on his Instagram site at The Grief Navigator. And with that, Kevin, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast today. I've been looking forward to this conversation for some time.
Thank you, David. Your title of Teaching Journeys, it always connects me with my own career as a teacher and educator. So I love the title. And is there ever a time that there isn't something to learn? I don't think so.
I've always told my guest contributors, I've told the students that I teach at Utica University and Pratt School of Art, is that once I cease to learn from your experiences, then it's probably going to be time for me to find a new career.
Mm-hmm.
It's what helps us to continue to grow. So with that, my first question for you is, please tell our listeners about the experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions today.
For me, I've been shaped by the beginning experiences, and I feel blessed with the environment in which I grew up in. It was unique. I've met people along in my life that say, oh, their childhood was awful. Their childhood was, they have residue. I don't have that. And I feel blessed. And that's certainly something that shaped me, because I think it gave me a sense of optimism, a sense of wherewithal and resiliency, purpose. I was, we've talked about it, but I was raised in a funeral home, which in itself is a unique environment. And from the time I was born in 1950, when they brought me home and put my bassinet in my bedroom on the third floor above where the funeral home is, till I was 22, 23, and finishing college and starting out on my own, those were very formative years. And so much of what I learned, even though I didn't carry on the business, so much of what I learned in my youth, in my teens, in my 20s, from my mother and father, my aunt and uncle, shaped me in the education career I pursued. So when using that word shape again, I catch myself Well, even there's things that shaped me in my, even as recently as last night. I'm pretty active, as you said, I'm pretty active in theater. You know, we had a rehearsal last night. And so at the end, I wanted to help the person directing. I said, what do you want me to do with these chairs? She said, just put them on, you can stack them on that rack. So immediately as I was stacking the chairs, I went right back to my time in the funeral home. Because so much of life in the funeral home is planning for the next wake or funeral and cleaning up after. And so a lot of my role as a kid was to put up and take down chairs. So when I think about things that have shaped me and the things that I did without even thinking, that's carried through even to as recently as last night. It's over. I'm still being shaped.
And we'll continue to be shaped by our experiences and other circumstances that come across. But interestingly, that to me is as important of a task to set up chairs and do the setup, because that is something that's a little details, I think, in the funeral business. And how you do that, I think, that communicates to the family that you care. That the little things matter as much as the big things do. And sometimes, I think doing those little things, it gives them one less thing to think about, you know, as they're trying to process the initial shock of the death of their loved ones.
And one of the things my dad taught me, and I used this when I was a school principal too, he said when he would have a pretty good reading about the family that was coming in and what he was trying to gauge, how many people to prepare for. And he would think, well, I want to have chairs for people and comfortable seating, but he usually opted for setting up less chairs because he thought that if he needed to set up more, then the family felt a little different. Hey, there's more people coming. They have to set up more chairs. And I did the same thing when I would set up for an assembly at school or with parents coming. I'd have my custodial crew and we set up chairs and I said, we'll be ready to set up the rest. Partly because if you set them all up and you don't need them, it's more put away, the practical sense. But on the other hand, it gives up for, in this case, in a school setting, the performers, the idea that, hey, this place, we're so popular, there's more people coming. And in the same, in the funeral home setting, it's when the family knew, because you never really know how many people are going to come to a wake or a funeral. They don't ask for RSVPs for those things. But that whole idea to just have a sense and an appreciation for family's feelings about the attendance. And I think Dad was, I learned that. You talk about things that shaped me. That's something that shaped me right there.
And as you were talking about setting up chairs and making sure everything was in order for that part of the celebration of life, I went back to the time of my daughter's celebration of life or wake, however you choose to conceive it, where my brother-in-law was handling the funeral arrangements. And one of the things he came up to me and said, we got the car situation all settled. We know who's going in which car. And I remember just showing such a great amount of appreciation because that's something I hadn't even thought about.
Oh, yeah.
But he took care of those details so I didn't have to deal about that.
Yes.
Deal to worry about that. And that's, I think, one of the things that is a misconception. What a lot of people don't understand about what funeral directors do, it isn't just about, okay, making the arrangements. Do you want to be embalmed? Do you want to be cremated? It's those little things that communicate to the family that you are the most important family that I'm dealing with at this particular moment. And we're going to take care of the little things so that you can worry about the bigger things. And what it boils down to me is it's what gets lost is that this is a service industry. And what funeral directors are tremendous at is providing service to families who are grieving. And sometimes I think that gets overlooked.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. And I think when I've talked to students or about my own experience, the whole thing about what a funeral director has to do. You talk about a to-do list. I don't ever remember seeing my dad with a to-do list. I think it was all up in his head. But one of the things was listening to the family. And so when a family comes in to make arrangements, he listens. You know, who do you think will be coming? Who needs to have a ride to the cemetery? What will you be doing afterwards? Let me help you. And then it's like you said just previously, so that takes that load off the family. He and my uncle could get enough from the conversations they had with the family initially or with follow-up conversations to say, okay, this is what we need to be ready for. And if it's a family member who isn't going to be quite accepting of this death, or what might we be aware of? Or is there anybody that's going to have a hard time with this that we can be of assistance and stuff? So I think that was kind of the thing that paying attention and service and listening. It's really an important traits of any industry, but certainly this one.
Well, and the other thing that I think tends to get overlooked is funeral directors' expertise at conflict resolution, because a lot of times families will be fighting over incidental details. And funeral directors, I think a lot of times will find themselves in the middle of that. And they need to learn how to very deftly work through that. And, you know, from what I can see, they do that very well. And I tell my students, make sure if there's a funeral directors association in your area, get acquainted with funeral directors, particularly if you're working with families, understand what they do, cultivate relationships, because at the time of crisis for a family, they're there in the right in the trenches at the time of crisis. They do their best and they do really, really masterful work at getting them through crisis situations so that other, you know, mental health and health service professionals can work effectively with them in the aftermath.
Oh, yeah. It's really like being there. Like, my dad did a few stage direction things of plays and musical things, but being a funeral director is very similar to that. You're called a funeral director. Oh. So what you're doing is just putting all those moving pieces together to make them work and set the stage in a way that is very welcoming to the audience and stuff like that. Getting into my theater terms here, but I think that's a major part of what a funeral director does.
Absolutely. And that segues into my next point about your really, really excellent book, Two Floors Above Grief, which documented the 54-year history of the O'Connor Funeral Home. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Why was it important for you to write a book about the histories of your two families that were involved in the funeral business? And what do you want readers to take away from reading?
Super questions. Well, it was important to me to do it because there were so many stories. Not only did I live in a house in a unique environment with my aunt and uncle and their three daughters, and my dad and my mom and two brothers, that was one thing, but we had a very large extended family. My dad and mom, my aunt, they had extended families that would come to the house often. So that built into the storytelling and into the things that would happen in the house, and aside from having a funeral. So there was those kind of stories that were there all the time. And people would say, who's going to tell these stories? And the other thing that was unique about our environment was it's not unusual for funeral directors to live near or in the establishment. What was different about our house, my dad and uncle had converted this single family, three-story Victorian house into the business and the apartments. But in doing so, they took the second floor, which were essentially bedrooms, and made that into a living environment. And they take the third floor, which had been the ballroom of the original house, and made that into another living environment. That's where I lived. But for me and my brothers and my mom and my dad to go to our apartment, we had to go through my aunt and uncle's second floor apartment, either walking through their dining room or the back stairs would lead right past their kitchen apartment. The concept of privacy wasn't, it wasn't like we would know it, you know? And I touch upon that in the book a little bit. And I guess the other reason I wanted to tell the story, too, is because these are two families that got along. Yeah, there was some tension, and I explained that in the book a little bit, but nothing that was going to split the business up or nothing that there was going to be fisticuffs or anything like that or threats or anything like that. These two guys and their wives managed to work through this and live in this, I call them conjoined apartments, shared apartments, And our third floor really had more of the, we had more privacy because once we got there, we were there in our own living room, kitchen, bedrooms. And even my aunt and uncle, when they would want to come up and have a conversation, they would usually say from the bottom of the steps, it's okay for us to come up. Okay for us. They had that discretion, whereas they didn't have that choice to walk down. Not that we took over. We would walk. There are many times I could walk down the back stairs and not even see them. Or if I walked down the back stairs and I knew my aunt was in the kitchen, she said, where are you going? And I said, I'm just going to play. And that would be it. You know, it wasn't a thing that she was going to break up her routine or anything. So that made it very unique. And I think the second part of your question was, what kind of effect, what kind of impact did I want to have on readers, I think?
Or what do you want readers to take away?
Well, as you noticed, the book is based on many letters that went back and forth. Family letters that were handwritten, in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Actually, I go back to a letter that my mom wrote in 1939. So, and I put the letters right in, not the actual letters, but I transcribed the letters right into the book. So one of the things I want readers to take away is an undercurrent of the stories themselves is just the impact of the written word and the idea that in this time and place, 2024, and the last 25 years, there's a lot of people who don't have a concept of what it is to write or to receive a letter. And the book has the good fortune to get ranked high on Amazon with teens and young adults. And when I've had the opportunity to ask teens and young adults, a couple of responses have said, I like that part about all those letters. I didn't know what that was about. I didn't know. And so I think there's that. That's another thing I think I want readers to take away. I want readers also to take away the idea of an understanding of the funeral home profession. I had a reader write to me in the last 6 or 7 months. She was a friend of mine, but she had the book and her mother had passed. And she wrote me a nice note. She said, I'm having, of course, a hard time with my mom's passing, but reading your family stories helped me to realize that there's families behind all the work that went into my mother's funeral. And the appreciation for the family that did her parents' services. And I think was that on a poster board that I said, this is what I want my readers to do when they read the book? No, but it's something that's been happening as I read reviews and things. So that's another thing that's come out that I think readers are taking away. The different personalities of the characters that come out through the written word. The magic of those handwritten letters, some of them are typed, is when I would receive those letters when I was a student in Chicago or a student in Rome, Italy, sometimes I would get letters from three different people in the family on the same day, none of whom knew they were writing me the letter. They just took it upon themselves to write me a letter and stick it in the mail. And they were reporting on the same incidents that were going on either in the business or in the family or in the town. And they all had a different perspective. So it was interesting to me, and I think that for what I want readers to take away, is just the beauty of communication and the idea that whether we're listening through letter writing or listening through our ears, there's a lot of different voices out there. And so I think that's one of the things I wanted readers to take away. And the other thing was the idea that I wanted the book to go beyond just my family, and it has. My family wanted me to write the book because they wanted some of the sense of history. But I think for other readers, it's the idea of family working together and family navigating situations. And how do they do that? And the stories that I told, I think, convey that. And I like to think that people that are reading the book, whose parents, they might have lived above their father's pediatrician office, or they might have lived upstairs from their dad's print office. I'm thinking of kids I grew up with. But that they too had the stories and they too had families that worked together to keep those businesses going. And even if you're 5 years old or 6 years old, you can still carry a plant to the car or things that I used to do. I can vacuum. I was vacuuming by the time I was 5 or 6, just to help, you know. So we all help with our parents. So many of us have had the opportunity to help with their parents' business.
I think the way you set that up in the book, and in terms of talking about, you know, which individuals in the family had which specific roles, that's a great model for just running a business where mm-hmm. everybody has responsibility. I also got the sense that no job was too big or small for anybody to do. Your Uncle Lawrence, and your Aunt Mildred, and your father, and his name escapes me at this point, so I apologize for
that. Who's that? Which one?
Your dad.
Oh, Bill.
Your dad, Bill, and your mom's name was?
Marion.
So, mm-hmm. Bill, there wasn't a job that was either too big or small for either Lawrence or Mildred or Bill and Marion.
Yeah.
They would do, And so if you ask me to do that same job as a kid, I'm thinking, well, geez, they did that. I can't say no to that. So it's really a great model for leadership from the front.
Oh, yeah. And so many of those roles were unspoken.
Yep.
And even they were not written expectations. But I know from a kid point of view, I mentioned it in the book, when I was out and about on my bike, playing in the park, pick up basketball or being at somebody else's house, I knew that my last name carried more than just my last name. That if I was not only representing who I was representing the business. And not that I was out there trying to steer people to our establishment, but I knew that if I had messed up, that might have impacted the family's decision. You know? So you're like ambassadors. And my mom and aunt, even though they weren't that actively involved in the business themselves, through all the things they did with different organizations, they were doing it because they enjoyed the people and enjoying being in those organizations. They weren't necessarily doing it to promote the business, but that was sort of ancillary. So that when they were involved in their car groups or service groups or whatever, people would connect them with the funeral home as well.
And that's one of the things that had escaped me, is that when you mentioned that you and the rest of the children in the family were ambassadors for the funeral home, your behavior in the community, if it was not up to normative speed, for lack of a better way to put that, it's going to reflect not only on your family, but the business as a whole. You know, can funeral directors develop their reputation being involved in their community? And if anything tarnishes that, it affects the bottom line of the business too, in terms of, well, I'm not going to want to go to a funeral director who may not have as much integrity or as somebody else may. And that's something that had escaped me.
Well, David, it's a very personal decision for a family. I think I mentioned in the book that one of my aunt's unspoken responsibilities was to listen to the obituaries on a local radio station every day. She had that radio station on anyway. It was her way to learn out know what's going on in town. This was the 1950s. Everybody used radio then. And but then she would keep a little tally mark. No, she would listen to the obituaries, not only to make sure that anybody that was at our house, our funeral home, was stated their obituary was correct, but also she would keep a little either mental or written tally mark about, oh, that family went there, that family went there, that family went there. But they didn't, I don't remember them ever spending a lot of time thinking, oh, why did they go there? Why did they? Mm-hmm. There were so many other factors. For as much as my four parents, for as much as they were involved in different community organizations, the funeral directors from the other 5 funeral homes were also involved in community organizations. So everybody had their own decisions, and it might have been the church that an undertaker belonged to. There's all kinds. So my aunt never really, she might just keep track, but she wouldn't say, oh, what are you going to do to go get that family back with us? Mm-hmm. I don't remember ever seeing that. They really respected the decision that each family made, you know, so.
And I think that's important to be able to empower families to make their own decisions. You know, when the O'Connor Funeral Home first opened their doors, there wasn't any such term as empowerment. But
you do
let families make their own decisions, because if you don't, and you try to force it, that's also going to get back out in the community as well, too.
Oh, so. Yeah. And I talked about my dad, my uncle's earlier marketing things and how he did it. And it has to be for a funeral home. I'm having never done it. I don't know. So I'm seeking out of school here. But with the sense I picked up from them and so many others of my dad's colleagues and mom's colleagues, uncle's colleagues, it's not something that you stand on a soapbox and say, hey, I'm the best undertaker in town. No. You rarely even see, as I drive around different places, you don't see billboards with that on there. You don't see, you see maybe advertisements in different programs and things, but it's just a very personable thing. So I think that's why in this industry, it's so important for people to be with other people. And so when you talk about your first question, what shaped me, what I always observed with the four adults in my life was how they operated within a group of people. Mm-hmm. They weren't going in there to sell the business. They were going in there because they had personalities that liked to do that. But then as they mixed with people and socialized with people, and whether it was from just a purely social sense, or whether it was from a church sense, or the Elks Club, or any one of the organizations they belonged to, it was just because they liked to be with people. You know? And I think that it's that kind of personableness that helps a profession like the funeral directorship succeed.
Well, and I think if you need to establish in any service-oriented industry, or especially where you're working directly with people, they need to feel safe with you. They need to feel safe with entrusting mm-hmm. their loved ones' arrangements to you.
Yes.
They're going to resonate with your personal characteristics initially beyond the credentials. And if you can't sell yourself as a person that can be trusted, that they will be safe with, they're going to go somewhere else.
We discovered in the last 5 years that one of my Uncle Lawrence's grandchildren found this among his things. And it was it's here in my house someplace. But anyway, it would hum in the preparation room, the embalming room. And it was a reminder to them, whoever was doing the work, whether my dad was doing the embalming or my uncle, or they hired sometimes people that were called trade embalmers that would come and do that phase of the work. Mm-hmm. But the thing that was hanging on the wall was saying, hey, this body that's laying here in front of you, this family is counting on you to treat them with the utmost respect and discretion. So and I believe that word discretion was in there. And Dad and Uncle Lawrence modeled that exquisitely. They, even though they were privy, you know, you'd mentioned earlier, if the family probably had some tension or some conflict or some things that had to be mediated, that was never brought upstairs to us. We as kids, or my mom and my aunt, may have known the names of the people that were of the family. They might have known them personally, but there was never details shared. And so when we would sit at the dinner table, it wasn't, how was your day? We talk about school, we talk about, you know, Dad may share a little bit, but it was never, ever about the family themselves. You may have talked about meeting the city clerk at the City Hall, or going to get the car washed, or things like that. But he never would talk about the personalities or the things that were going on with the family. So that discretion was so very key.
Yeah, as I think it is with any service industry, and particularly where HIPAA law now rules.
And, oh, and yeah.
You know, discretion is the better part of valor. I think.
My dad and uncle could have written HIPAA law, probably, because they followed it even before it was written. It comes down to how you treat people. And you mentioned earlier the concept of respect and trust and discretion. All those things are important in any industry, especially any service industry. And certainly it followed me into my education profession. Trust and respect, discretion, all that was so important as a teacher and a principal. So important.
Yeah, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. You mentioned in your your book that you had 12,500 yearly visitors to the O'Connor funeral home.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you, what did you learn about death and grief, not only from those visitors, but from how your family met with other families?
Super quick. Glad you picked out that tidbit from the book. That was fun that you spoke on that. Yeah, and I did that little estimation. I was just writing the book and knowing pretty much how many funerals they had each year. Some were small, some, that's where I came up with that number. There was nothing that I actually did a head count or went back into the sign-in books at the funeral and counted people. So, but I think it's a pretty good estimate. And I think that one of the things, and I kid in the book about how many of my friends had 12,000 people come through their house. I can't think of anybody. And I think for me to know that even though we had our private areas on the second and third floor, the house wasn't just ours. It was a community house. Mm-hmm. It was a place where people work. Even now, when I go back to my hometown, as recently as 2 or 3 weeks ago, people will tell me, oh, I remember being in the house. I remember being this, and we haven't had the business since 1984. I mean, it's still there, and people go to the current owner as well. But still, the idea that the living environment of our first floor was known to a lot of people. And so for me, one of my duties as a kid, probably beyond 11, 12, 13, 14, my brothers and I were sometimes, I don't remember ever being arm twisted to do this. It was just sort of, what are you guys doing tonight? Oh, we're just going to watch TV. No, I want you downstairs. You're going to open the door for 2 hours. So we put on a pair of khakis, a nice shirt, and stand at the front door and open the door. And if there was more than one family, then part of our questioning was, hey, I'm Kevin O'Connor. Welcome to O'Connor Funeral Home. Which family are you here to see? And then I would say, okay, go to the top of the stairs, turn left, turn right. And if they needed assistance, then I would help them up the stairs. This is before we had a handicap entrance. So were those kind of things that to have, they were guests in our house. And the other thing I think I talk about in the book is always having to be ready for the next funeral. Even if Dad and Uncle Lawrence finished a funeral on a given day and they came back and they didn't have anything else happening, they would go right to work to get something ready. They would have everything in order because even if they finished their funeral at 12, they got home, had some lunch, they knew that they didn't have any other clients coming in. But at 5 o'clock, the phone would ring, you know. So the idea was your day wasn't over. Your work wasn't over until you were ready for the next funeral. Sometimes you might get all that stuff ready, and it might be 3 weeks. Other times you might get it all ready because there was another wake happening that night or the next day. So that was that variable in the industry. So the idea of having 12,000 people in and out, 12,000 different personalities, when they decided to put an addition out of the house, they called it a new chapel. In doing so, they went from having one bathroom for everybody that was at a wake to having a men's room and a woman's room in the lower level. And I kid in the book about, you know, how many kids that I went to school with had a urinal in their house. So some days I would just go downstairs to use the urinal because I thought, wow, I live in a house that has a urinal. But that's a little bit of aside from the idea that there's so many people coming in and out of our house. And I didn't know any different. So that was just it. And I could look out the windows of our apartment and see all the cars that were lined up or the parking spaces and know that some wakes people would park on the street because we ran out of parking. We'd have to shovel and get ready if there was snow. That was another thing we had to get ready for if there was snow. You didn't usually stop a wake if there was a snowstorm. You just had to make sure your front door was shoveled and everything was salted. And so that's all the things we did. We had to be ready all the time.
If I were you and I was in that situation, I would learn very quickly that death is a part of life and something that we cannot avoid talking about, averting our eyes away from, and that we need to embrace that part of our lives as much as we do the living part of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so true. And I think that's a little bit what separates my brothers and I, and my three cousins who are now deceased themselves, what separated us a little bit from our friends. Even though our friends didn't, I don't remember our friends engaging us in that much conversation about it, but we had a little different understanding of that. And we had it on a daily basis because death could happen when I thought my dad was going to come and watch me play basketball, or it could happen when he was going to take me into the city for a special excursion. Well, can't do it. If it was a special occasion like a graduation, he and Uncle Lawrence would always figure it out that, okay, Bill, you're going to graduation. We'll figure it out. I'll be here. Those kind of things. But I think I might have realized that more so than other kids, that even though my parents came to most everything I did, there were times they didn't. And that was part of the reason, because that was the business. That was what they had to do.
Unfortunately, death and dying doesn't occur on our schedule. It occurs on a more divine schedule.
Yes. And in writing the book, I was able to recall that and bring it out in the book a little bit, that there is no schedule. I talk about the story of my 14-year-old friend dying, you know, 4 or 5 weeks after we graduated from eighth grade. Who would have thought that when we were sitting at graduation, that the next time our class would all be together would be 2 months later at his funeral? I mean, you don't think about stuff like that when you're 14. So I didn't, even having grown up in a funeral home, I didn't think it would be anybody my own age. So that was just another thing, another way that stuff got brought home to me. And did it make it any easier for me to understand his death or anything? I don't think so. I mean, I think all of us, we had 24 kids in our class. I think all 23 of us were grieving in different ways. So it was tough.
Well, and death changes the landscape of our lives, and particularly when it's a young adult who dies or transitions, as I like to call it, before the time, it begs us to take a look at our own beliefs, our own assumptions, and reevaluate who we are and who we want to be, and what's our life going to be like going forward without the physical presence of those individuals in our lives.
Yeah. Now, when you think about the idea that a funeral director takes on the grief of another family, I mentioned in the book about when I had the conversation right around the time my friend Francis died, I talked to my dad and said, what's toughest for you? And he said, when young people die, when babies die. He said, when he and my mom had 5 miscarriages. Why does that happen? You know, even being faced with death on a professional basis, having to put his hands around the idea that one of his friends would die, or one of his friends was killed, or my cousin in 1955 was killed in a car crash. I mean, so you don't think, he said, those are the toughest situations. So that whether they be close to home or close to family, or just him feeling the impact that it had on the family that he's working with. He said, those were the toughest cases, the toughest cases.
And any funeral director I've talked to in my hometown has told me that the toughest situation they have to deal with is when an infant dies or an adult child dies.
Mm-hmm.
That is heart-wrenching for them to have to go through.
Oh.
Funeral directors have to compartmentalize so they can provide quality service. But once it's all said and done, and once the arrangements are done and the funeral is done and the celebration of life is done, you know, it affects them in private.
My dad and my uncle, if a case was coming through, they didn't have a choice to pause and say, they couldn't even ask, how am I going to get through this? They just had to do it. They had to do it. And they just, the resiliency, the, looking for the right word, but just the wherewithal. And you use the word compartmentalize. They had to compartmentalize their own feelings about that situation and say, my job here is to help this family. That's my role of service. And then, you know, I talked earlier about, but what does an undertaker do with all that grief? What do they do with all the stuff they shoulder? It's really a mental health issue too. I think so.
As I was reading your book, I began to recall memories of my own childhood. I was raised by a single parent, my mother, but also my maternal grandmother and my maternal aunt. We all lived in the same house.
Okay.
And I started thinking about because I was reading about your two families.
Yeah.
You know, in a funeral home. What do you believe are the benefits of nostalgia to our overall well-being and our ability to work through grief?
Nostalgia, pretty powerful, huh? I share quite a bit of nostalgia in the book. You mentioned in the intro that one of my identities on Instagram now and Facebook too is called The Grief Navigator. And one of the things that I'm working on it as an extension of the book is to, like, as you are, you do this in your work too, is connecting people with ways that can help them, because there's no one situation that is the same. There's no similarity. There's plenty of resources. So what can I do to help a person navigate and make decisions through the resources I provide? So that the role of nostalgia, I think, just for me, when I look back at my own family, just knowing that even before my dad and uncle started this business and hearing their stories from their ancestors. Death, and as we talked about in this podcast, death doesn't escape any of us, you know. So for them, the nostalgia of growing up with a very close-knit family of aunts and uncles and grandparents, and my mom and aunt the same. So they carried that with us. So I think that the beauty of the nostalgia of what my family's had beforehand, I think carried into our own situation and helped me to develop that scope. I mentioned in the book that my mom and her two sisters, her parents owned a restaurant, and they lived upstairs above the restaurant in the same town. It was just a few blocks from where the funeral home was. So my mom was used to that idea of the business and living above the business. In our house, not only was it the 10 of us, on occasion, my aunt's mother lived with us. So we had that intergenerational thing too. Nostalgia was right there. It was present. It was very much a part of it. I think going back to one of your earlier questions, that was another motivation for me to write the book, because I wanted to tell this story. The subtitle is A Memoir of Two Families in the Unique Place We Call Home, because I think our living environment was quite unique. And I'm proud of that, happy with that, and glad that our family now, both my aunt and uncle and my dad and mom, who came together in the 1930s to start their marriage, to start their families, there's now 150 offspring from those two couples. And so the nostalgia, I did a book presentation in New York City a couple weeks ago, and two of the attendees happened to be part of that extended family who now live on Long Island, and they came in to listen. As I was talking about the book, I could point right to them, because they, even though they were now raising their own families on Long Island, they had been to the house in the 50s, and the 60s, and the 70s, so building on that nostalgia. So I think nostalgia is very, very important. As we navigate grief, we have to honor the nostalgia and know that our predecessors have navigated. They all got through grief. They taught us each time that they took us to a funeral, that they took us to a wake. They taught us. It's like I teach my kids and grandkids.
And you're not overusing the term navigator at all. I've used the term navigate grief frequently, and I think that's a really accurate way to conceptualize it. Is that we do navigate. The waters of grief, the rough terrain of grief, however you choose to conceptualize
the maps,
it.
The maps of grief, the GPS of grief, you know, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
Absolutely. In the last section of your book, you talk about the members of your family who have transitioned. Mm-hmm. And you also mention that you are a believer, and I'm quoting you, in unearthly celestial interventions. Which, and I'm a believer in that myself.
Right.
But what I'd like you to do for our listeners, for our viewers, is can you share a couple of your most memorable unearthly celestial interventions as it relates to the transitions of your family members?
Oh, yeah, sure. The one that comes, I'll mention the one about my father that I wrote about in the book. 2 days before he died, and you know, he was in hospice and he was living in his house. We weren't living in the funeral home then. They'd already sold it and he moved to a different house. My kids at the time, my two sons, were in 40 years ago because it was, he died in 1984. So my sons were two and just a baby. So we went over on a Friday night to see my dad, and he was in and out of consciousness. Also, the other thing we had going on in our life at that time was that my wife and I, we lived in a townhouse, a condo that we were outgrowing because we had these two babies now, and we were looking to get, have some options to buy something else. We'd had the townhouse on the market for a year. We hadn't had one person look at the place, not one. So right around the time Dad was transitioning and dying that week, my wife and I also made arrangements to change realtors. And we switched realtors. The realtor's name, Cindy. So it comes to Dad, that's Friday night. And Dad's having this conversation with me. He's saying, we really got to sell that condo. We need a yard for the boys to play. We want that for the boys. And so I hope we can do something. He kept saying, I hope we can do something to get your place sold. And then he dozed off that night. That was my last conversation with him. He died that Sunday morning. I didn't make it in time for passing. Tuesday, the wake is happening. And I'm standing there. And Cindy, the realtor, comes up to me. And she says, hey, I think I might have somebody. I said, what do you mean you might have somebody? Well, we were talking in the office about your condo, and somebody said they knew of somebody that might be interested. And I'm going to be meeting with him tomorrow while you're at the funeral. And I said, Cindy, nobody's even looked at the place in a year. So Wednesday's this funeral, and in the late afternoon, after we've done the funeral and the luncheon and the post-luncheon and the whatever that we do as a family, I get a call. Somehow or another, and it's Cindy. And she said, I have a guy that wants to make an offer. He's going to, can I call you Thursday morning? I know you're pretty busy with everything. I said, yeah, call me. So the next morning, he calls. We figure out what we agree on the offer. Friday morning, we sign the papers. So within a week after my dad and I had this conversation, the place was sold. After not having ever been looked at. And whatever he did, I still think it's him, because that was his last conversation. When I talk about celestial happenings, I think in his own space where he was at, he figured out a way to find this guy to be discussed at the office where Cindy, he didn't know Cindy, where Cindy was, but to this day, 4 years later, I think that condo sold because of my dad. And that was one event that was, I considered, more of a celestial connection, a happening that came with the family. And I think that is, I think that's pretty, one of them that's really happened. So.
And for me, it's, I can't consensually validate anybody else's experience with unearthly celestial interventions. Right. I can only take a look at the significance of it through their eyes in terms of how it made them feel, what they described as going on at the present moment, because what we interpret as a sign or a nudge from beyond or an unearthly celestial intervention is always a product of what's going on in the moment. And if that's what it meant to you, and that's all that matters. And I had a smile on my face because it's very similar to experiences that I've had with my daughter and my other deceased ancestor. Mm-hmm. So
And
a lot of times I think to expand our belief system, we need to think beyond what is possible, beyond the physical world, and embrace that.
I still believe that. I don't do much religion stuff, but I do believe that there's a place that we go to, and then they were there. And I believe that time is an essence to my dad, who's been gone 40 years. Mm-hmm. He's probably looking at me as the 35-year-old he left when he died, maybe, but he sees me as a 74-year-old. But I still turn to him and, hey, can you give me a pointer here? Or, hey, can you get together with the others that you're probably communicating with and help me out of this jam? And I think they do have something to do with the decisions that we're led to. I don't think they help me make the decision, but they lead me to things that are going to help. So I really think that.
And I agree with that observation too, Kevin. If you are going to leave our visitors with one thing today, what would that be?
I think one thing I would leave the listeners with, and this show talks a lot about grief and transitions and how we navigate those passages. One thing I want to leave people with is just the individualization of each of those journeys, and whether we're looking at that from the person who's passing, or our reactions. And I think we've mentioned even in this call that we can never be experienced enough with grief. I found some things that worked when my mom died in 2010, it doesn't mean that it worked for me when my mother-in-law passed 2 years later, or when I had other friends or family that had died in the 14 years since my mom died. Each situation is different. So one of the things I want to leave with readers is this, the idea to respect the presence of what's happening. And when a person says, hey, how come we can't do it the way we did the last time? Well, I think part of it is because it's not the last time. It's the now time. And what were the wishes of this deceased person? And who's in the family dynamic now that wasn't there when the last one happened? So all those variables change. When I'm thinking about leaving with readers, I think about there's joy in grief. It's veiled, but I think it's worth discovering. And I think part of that joy is knowing that each passage, each transition, each dynamic presents a new set of stories, a new set of ways to do things. I'm always intrigued with the relationships that develop during and after a funeral. Family members or friends that I may have not had much association with up to that point in time, but all of a sudden after the funeral, we're talking, we're doing social engagements, and just how, and I think maybe, going back to my story about my dad, I'm thinking that maybe the person who passes on has something to do with that. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that in the book when my Aunt Mildred died. I think she had something to do with how the business was going to look after she died. She put the players in place to make it happen. Not that we all agreed with what was happening, but I think she did. And I want to leave readers with that idea that each situation is, everybody has their two floors of grief, whether it's next door to grief or whether it's down the street or whether it's in the room next to you. But there's a beauty in it. As hard as it is to see the beauty, there's a beauty in individuality, which makes it, for me, more enticing and helps. It's helped me to navigate when I look at each situation and think, oh, this is different than the last time. But, hey, it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Well, thank you, Kevin. And I agree. We all don't grieve the same way. I think cause of death, the nature of the relationship at the time of that person's transition, there's a lot of things that play into that. And what I hear you saying is we also need to respect the individualization in the grief process, because it's different for everybody.
And I think that's where you see the expertise of those in the death care industry and how they do that and how the psychology behind it and the empathy and the personality behind it is so vital.
I agree. My last question, tell our listeners, our audience, how they can best get in touch with you. I know we mentioned that in the beginning when we read your bio,
Yeah.
Let's repeat that again at the end to make sure we get that in.
Sure.
And also it'll be in the program notes as well.
Okay. Yeah, you had mentioned before that I have a website, Kevin O'Connor. That's O'Connor is O-R. Kevin O'Connor, author.com. And when they go to that site, there's a place where they can put their name and their email address. That will connect them with a newsletter that I endeavor to get out once a week. I have a newsletter that just talks about different aspects of the book or different things that I've discovered along the journey of grief. So that's one thing. So Kevin O'Connor, author.com. If they want, you know, even more immediate, they can just contact me at my email address, which is koco7351@gmail.com. Or my phone number, which is great for texting, 815-546-1076. So those will be the three primary ways they can get a hold of me. And then you'll have in the show notes, I'm on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, a few other places, so that they can find me through there as well.
Kevin, thank you so much for being a valuable guest contributor on the Teaching Journeys podcast. I truly enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed our dialogue.
With that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.